It is a $700 billion a year business, and Americans spend about 2% of their lives shopping in them. Wow, that story leads us to ask, how did 7-Eleven give rise to Trader Joe's?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello, folks. Welcome aboard. You are tuned into the 1250th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in London who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, not too long ago, most all of us lived very close to the source of our food. If we did not grow the food ourselves, we most likely knew the people who grew it for us. That was the way it was because that was the way it had to be. There simply was no other way. Then we developed the means to process food so that it would last longer and package it so that it could be shipped further. And with those technologies, our food became groceries, and those groceries were sold in grocery stores. Then we developed even more ways to process foods and better ways to package it so now it could be shipped clear across the world. All you can eat shrimp, anyone? And we also developed information management systems that made it possible to keep track of it all. And with all those technological advances, grocery stores became supermarkets containing over 100,000 store-keeping units, or SKUs. The transformation of food into SKUs is the story of people finding their way in the world with their food. And so today we pause to ask, how did 7-Eleven give rise to Trader Joe's? Who better to ask than the man who told the story, Benjamin Lohr, who is the author of The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Total pleasure.
Yeah, brand new book, fresh out of the oven, and it's a real big story. So I got to ask, do you remember that moment when the apple fell on your head and you decided you had to tell the whole story about grocery stores and supermarkets? That's a big undertaking.
Yes, there was an actual apple on head moment. Well, not featuring an apple, but my previous book was looking at Bikram yoga, kind of why a very obsessive form of yoga and featuring kind of a narcissistic, almost Trumpian guru. And I was very interested in why people were so attracted to this yoga. And I was doing a lot of it. And I went to one of his teacher trainings. And at this teacher training, all the yogis are kind of locked up doing yoga all the time. And they let them out to go to the grocery store. And it happened to be a Trader Joe's. And they got out and just kind of, I'd never seen this maniacal glee in adult humans descending on this Trader Joe's. And the happiness that it inspired in them reminded me a lot of the obsession and passion that they were bringing to yoga. And it just kind of opened this window in my mind that our relationship, our consumption patterns with food and the kind of cult of food and the way food has changed over my life from just being something you picked up in a drab supermarket to something that really had a lot of meaning and identity and was capable of creating this maniacal glee. That was my apple moment where I was like, I want to learn more about how a supermarket functions.
Well, that's a pretty good apple moment. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, before I even knew of your book, I was driving by Trader Joe's to see if it would be possible for me to get in and get those items my wife has been wanting. But there was an hour-long line just waiting to get into into Trader Joe's. And I thought, you people are crazy, but maybe they're not.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not.
Well, we're all crazy in our own ways. I think that that's one of the things I learned from this book. And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but Trader Joe's does an amazing job at targeting a specific demographic and then giving that demographic what they want. And that involved a kind of scrutiny, a humanism in terms of understanding people that I think it's easy to dismiss if you are not part of that demographic, it either comes off as tacky, bougie, maybe it comes off as like featuring too many packaged foods. You know, it just depends where you fall on the spectrum. But
he figured out how to get us, I'll tell you that.
He figured out how to get it, and he zeroed in on a type consumer way back in the mid-60s that really became ascendant in America. And I think for me, that was one of the reasons why it was an interesting story to tell.
And we look forward to hearing it, too. But before we do, I'd like to get into the whole business of how food became SKUs.
Yeah,
just kind of it's kind of a quick thumbnail of that incredible, because it's a history of us, if you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I really loved your framing, actually, at the beginning of this show. The ways that the rise of food being sold at stores that were actually very intimately connected to agriculture, for no other reason than most of America was buying this food on credit. And so if you were in agriculture, as many more percentage of the population most of us were, because that's what it took to grow the food that we needed to survive. And you had a bad season, you couldn't pay for the food you had already bought from the store because it was all bought on credit. And so the store was very intimately connected to the farm in a way that it's not anymore. And then, as you pointed out, like the rise of kind of packaging technology, cardboard box comes. I always say, you know, forget the wheel when it comes to technology that has kind of come to define our lives and like these like miracle inventions. The cardboard box enabled like transport of food over great distance in a much more convenient fashion. Rise of tinning and canning. That was done in the name of trade and done in the name of, you know, keeping food safe. But it created a parallel dynamic, which is all of a sudden you had all these individual boxes and cans that needed labels on them and then needed names. And once you give something a label and a name, you give it a brand identity. And once you give it a brand identity, people can choose between different brands. And that act of choice is a place that they unconsciously inject meaning into. So suddenly you're sifting between options and you choose one because it's something your husband would like more. That's an act of love. Or you choose to spend less money because you're saving it for some big purchase at home. That's an act of frugality that also becomes an act of love. And so the technological shifts in cardboard and tin and canning also have kind of almost a spiritual or immaterial dimensions into how we shop. And that had structural shifts on the store. So if we go back to that, the store that I was talking about that was intimately connected to the farm, that was called a general store. You know, it sold boots, it sold local produce, it sold hardware, it sold drugs, and all of that was behind the counter. And it was all sold in that anonymous bulk. But once you get people sifting through and creating meaning in their products, they want to reach out and touch it. And that was kind of the first shift into the supermarket. A gentleman named Clarence Saunders, who started a chain called the Piggly Wiggly, decides that he's going to let customers touch the items themselves. They're not going to be sold just by a clerk behind the counter, and he's going to put them on display. And then another gentleman...
But there was before you go on, I'd like you to brief us on the technological breakthrough of cardboard, which was really significant.
Sure. It's not just significant, it's kind of fascinating. So cardboard, in some senses of the word, had been around since the Chinese 1,000 years ago, or 1,000 years plus. But it hadn't been used for trade. It was used, I think, as an artistic medium. And the big invention came, corrugated cardboard is really two pieces of this kind of thick paper within a center that is folded up like arches, like a cathedral arch, which gives it a much stronger structural stability, you know, in the same way that a cathedral arch supports the building. And that smooshing of the two planes together and preserving the arch capacity of the third in between created this new very cheap to produce, but very hardy material. And it was first used to create structure in gentlemen's hats, but very quickly people discovered that this was a great medium for boxes. At first, they had to kind of be hand-folded laboriously, but by the 1890s, somebody had invented a factory, Robert Gehr and Flynn, actually, that they could mass-produce these boxes, and the race was kind of on for shipping packages.
And then we got into transportation, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because now we had something that we could throw onto the boxcar or into the back of the truck, and away we go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you go from a place in like 1850, there was almost zero packaged food. All, you know, the fruit that was coming to the general store was coming in a big barrel that, you know, would be chiseled out of it. To by 1900, about a fifth of all U.S. manufacturing is this packaging of food. So it had it was a tremendous shift in the landscape.
And it progresses and on and on and on and on. And now we have all-you-can-eat shrimp. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I think so. The next big shift in this was a gentleman named Michael Cullen realized that if he supersized his offerings, there was a ton of cost savings. And it's the classic American, we're just going to make it more, and that's enough. And it had real material effects, and it was you know what we think of as a supermarket, but essentially it allowed him to play a volume game, where if you sold a lot, if you intended to make your money based on volume, you could shrink down the margin that you were taking. So that was probably the primary shift. And to advertise his new store, it was called the King Cullen. His name was Michael Cullen. He just printed up broadsheets of prices and listed them up and down the newspaper page. And
which you still see today. You still see that today.
You still see it today, but it was at that point in time in 1930, it was earth shattering. People drove 50 miles away to get to his store, and there were huge lines and circuses, kind of like your pandemic lines at Trader Joe's. And that, of course, allowed him to then rent property that was off the main street. He would get bigger store designs. He would have to hire less employees because he was just heaping things up in bulk, and it didn't have to be a clerk behind a counter. And so there were all these cost savings that went into creating cheap food that kind of fueled itself in a feedback loop that made buying just a frenzy. And it's something that's a little hard to wrap our heads around, because right now going to the supermarket is a chore. It's obnoxious. We might associate it with packaged food that we think is unhealthy. And that's the mindset now. But at the time, it was almost disassociative. People shopping in his stores pronounced themselves faint. They worried that they were going to get lost. These were 6,000 square foot stores. Today, a Costco is 200,000 square feet.
With lots and 120,000 store keeping units from which to select. Yeah. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Benjamin Lohr, author of The Secret Life of Groceries. And one of those secret lives was the story on how 7-Eleven begat Trader Joe's. And it is an amazing story. And so I picked up on that right away, and we're going to bring it to you. So do stay tuned. Learn all about how 7-Eleven brought you Trader Joe's right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. We are talking about the food chain, by golly, and if the supermarket world isn't a good representation of the food chain, I don't know what is. And it's a wild and crazy world out there. Why did you use the terms that you expressed? Let's see, the dark miracle and the secret life.
I mean, to me, one of the big parts of this book that I wanted to bang home was just how miraculous our food system is. As you correctly noted, I think it's something like 80 to 90% of the American public worked in agriculture around the turn of the century. That would be the turn of the 18th to 19th century. And now it's less than 10% of people work there. At the same time, food prices have fallen from about 40% of the family budget to less than 10% of the family budget. In America, we pay less for our food percent of income than anywhere else on the planet.
That's a certifiable miracle, in a way.
It's a certifiable miracle. I mean, again, to contextualize this, when the first American supermarket opened in Rome, the first shoppers lost their minds. They were running up, and there was a woman who was running up and down the aisle screaming, "This is heaven." And the press reporters talk about other Italian women standing there shrieking, goggle-eyed, stunned, right? We've lost that sense of the miracle. I mean, I get it occasionally. I'll go into a supermarket and I'll feel 100% like I'm hallucinating because it's this saturated colors. And there's a sense of both soothing privilege there and absolutely menacing power, I think, in the supermarket with that abundance of options and raft of choices. And I really wanted to scratch the surface of that and acknowledging the fact that that comes with some darkness.
As you scratch the surface, would you describe the cleaning of the fish counter at a New York City Whole Foods market? Now, folks, if you really want to go for a ride, check that story out. But I do want to get back to the story of 7-Eleven and Trader Joe's, because it was a wonderful way of describing the magnificent way people come to grips with obstacles and find ways of overcoming them. Let's start with 7-Eleven, which began, I believe, as a Southland Corporation, correct?
Yeah, 7-Eleven is the Southland Corporation, and the Southland Corporation was founded in Dallas, Texas, to sell ice. And most of us have forgotten that ice was big business back in the day, especially before artificial ice could be created. If you're living in Dallas, Texas, with the Dallas, Texas heat, getting some cool ice was a primal need in the summer. And there used to be a big business of carving up lakes in the Northeast and Canada, packing it in sawdust, shipping it all over the place. Southland was one of the first in the 1890s to start making artificial ice with refrigerants.
But first, describe the ice houses.
Yeah. Ice houses in the Northeast were kind of way stations. They would carve up this ice and they would put it in these ice houses, pack it in with sawdust. But then Southland was operating what maybe you're referring to as kind of like ice docks, which were a little like gas stations.
Yes, exactly.
That people would drive up their, they would take their mule driven cart and bring it to there, and they would take someone would chisel off ice, slide it onto the cart, and they'd take it home to their ice box, which was their version of their refrigerator where they could keep perishable goods. And 7-Eleven came from that, in that what the ice docks tended to have slightly later hours, and a woman drove up to the ice dock and wished out loud, this is the apocryphal story, that the man could sell her some eggs as well as the ice. And the light bulb went off, and soon these ice docks started selling small perishable foods alongside of it, and the convenience store was really born from that.
And the interesting thing about that, though, was that they had great locations, right? These ice shacks.
Yes, They were located in really convenient places, and they were kind of hungering for a year-round business because, you know, ice in the winter, not the greatest business. So this idea takes off like a rash and starts spreading all over the place. That has become 7-Eleven. And to tie it into Trader Joe's.
Well, wait a minute. We have to learn how it got its name.
Yeah, well, it got its name straight from the facts. It stayed open later than the grocery store. The typical grocery store was only open from, say, 9 to 5. And the convenience store at the ice dock would stay open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., stretching outside of the hottest hours of the day to allow the customers to, again, kind of get some respite from that Dallas heat. And they decided that if we just codified that and all the ice docks will adopt that time, then we can just, that's our name.
And there you go. You have the birth of a huge industry of convenience stores. And it seems to me in reading your account of this story that one of the greatest benefits given the 7-Eleven brand was the location of the ice shacks. It was just the convenient locations. So there's your start.
Yes. And this all actually, the location and the convenience comes to a head in the birth of Trader Joe's. So we want to fast forward to the late 1950s. 7-Eleven is very much a behemoth at that point. There are thousands of them.
How did 7-Eleven grow so quickly, though? What was the story behind the growth, that tremendous growth of 7-Elevens, and so quickly?
Ooh. That's a good question. I mean, I would be slightly speculating. I think they, one, hit a great idea that people were hungering for. Two, they had the infrastructure set up. They had these ice docks. These ice docks existed. So applying it to the existing ice docks was not very difficult. Second, I think Southland had money so that they were able to undertake that expansion.
Down there in the oil patch, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So you take money from the oil and turn it into 7-Elevens, and now you see them everywhere. They're ubiquitous.
That's right.
Company-owned or privately owned?
I believe at this point 7-Eleven is franchise.
Okay.
But, you know, I can't speak to the modern 7-Eleven. I mean, I only know how gargantuan it is in Asia, too. The 7-Elevens I grew up with in suburban Maryland, I was surprised when I was doing the research for this book in Thailand, just how many 7-Eleven is a fat part of the fabric of my life in a way that I was probably naive, did not expect.
Yeah. And so they are. So cut away to the late 1950s.
Yeah.
And so, we have this interesting character named Joe Conforti, correct?
Joe Colum was the founder of Trader Joe's. He is a fantastically smart guy. He was working for a company called Owl Drug, which was going out of business. And they asked him why it was going out of business. He did some research. He came up with 7-Eleven as a far superior offering in the space. And the people he was working for said, well, why don't you go set up some imitation 7-Elevens? And he did that and founded a drugstore chain called the Pronto's Drug. Pronto's supermarket or Mark. And then 7-Eleven rolls into town and he knows he's doomed.
This is Southern California, right?
This is Southern California. Again, to go back to your real estate comments, he understands that 7-Eleven has the biggest balance sheet. And because of that, we'll be able to get the best real estate because any bank will want to go with the company that has the most resources and won't want to side with a little guy like him. And so they'll swoop in, get the best real estate, and his little Pronto market chain is doomed. And he doesn't want this. And he decides very counterintuitively at the time and even today that his only way to survive is to kind of make a lateral shift. In grocery to this moment, basically the only way to get better was to get bigger. And you see that with Amazon and Walmart today. But it was very true at the time. And he realizes intuitively that will never work for him. And what he has to do is get more targeted to specific consumers and sell goods that he starts calling them outstanding, by which he means they are noticeably more distinct from, you know, he has a very complicated way of
you tell a wonderful story about when he came to the conclusion that he would never be able to compete with 7-Eleven. He took the family and went away and sat down on a nice white beach and thought about it. And that story of thinking about it was really wonderful and perhaps a good lesson for all of us. Would you give us a thumbnail of that decision-making process he went through?
Yeah, so Joe was a real thinker of the world. And he really gave me faith in the idea of business as being a creative act. He had this existential threat of 7-Eleven moving in. And rather than panic, he went back to first principles. And he kind of said, well, what's the grocery store do? And what do consumers want? And he thought big picture about society. And he kind of noticed three big trends that were happening in the mid-60s when this happened. And one was the GI Bill, which was guaranteed a right to college education. And this was rapidly creating opportunities for people who were otherwise qualified to go to college but just couldn't afford it before. And it was about to hit a third generation with people in Vietnam, which meant a much larger section of the population would become college educated. And he thought people who are college educated are going to want to eat differently. It's going to make them think about the world differently. And he was very careful. He didn't think they were going to get any smarter for becoming college educated. He did think they were going to want to flex their educational muscles. They were going to want to use the new jargon that they were picking up.
I think you quoted him as saying better educated, but not more intelligent.
Yes, that sounds right. And so that was one observation he made.
We're going to have better educated people. And the GI Bill is changing how we go about thinking about things now. So that's a pretty dramatic, huge, significant shift.
Yeah, and to think about that as a grocery store owner and to apply those shifts, I think that's where his particular genius comes in. And the other thing he noticed is, of course, travel, as the cliche goes, is a form of education.
Boeing 747.
Yeah, the Boeing 747 was coming online right around then, something we probably take for granted, but this was twice the size of the previous Boeing airplane. Joe realized this is going to democratize travel. At that point in time, most people had not stepped foot on a plane. And he thought, okay, this new plane is going to allow everybody to have international travel. And when to travel internationally, you're going to want to come back and find in the stores some of the food products that you saw over there. And that's going to radically change who, or what people want from the store that
It also gave him a different idea about the efficiency of employees too, because with relatively fewer more people, you could serve a whole bunch more people, and therefore each of his employees, and he always paid good money for his employees, did you not?
Yes. So these are great contextual. So he had staked out, and again, very much in opposition to 7-Eleven, he decided he was going to pay his employees well. And his kind of rationale for that was really funny. He was just like, life's too short. I don't want to work around people who aren't the best. I want to work with good people. And so I'm going to have to pay them well to do that. And the result of that strategy, though, is when you think about expanding, there's multiple ways and dimensions to expand. You can expand by expanding the physical footprint of a store or by opening many new stores. If you do that, you're going to have to continually expand the population of employees, right? And that becomes harder to do when you are paying premium wages. But with the 747 taught Joe, because the 747 was bigger, it was more expensive, but it only, because it's an airplane, needed a much smaller percent of new employees. You don't linearly scale up the number of airline stewardesses based on the, you know, when you're moving plane to plane, the seats scale up much quicker. So he thought, how can I invest in my grocery store in a similar way? And one of the ways he thought of doing this was like with liquor licenses. They're very expensive. If I invest in liquor licenses and invest in these, or invest in the supply chain and getting buyers who really know the supply chain well, I'm actually not hiring more people, but I'm using their talents better with a deeper investment. So he was one of these guys with just a really unique antenna for the world, and really able to pay attention to things with a non-judgmental factor and learn from them and steal from them. And then in his case, he was obsessed with tying it back to the grocery industry.
So a very liberal arts kind of guy. He looked at everything. Nothing was beyond his purview. He sucked up information from everywhere and always asked, what does that mean? And one of the things you point out about him is that he was an excellent asker of questions. And you once, mm-hmm. he told the story of how he took a job at a grocery store. He was a Stanford MBA and took a job mopping floors for the privilege of asking the store owner questions. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. We will be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about how 7-Eleven begat Trader Joe's. What a story.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, that is me, Michael Olson, with Benjamin Lohr, who is the author of The Secret Life of Groceries. We were talking about Trader Joe himself and how he went from getting snowed under by the 7-Eleven Corporation, the 7-Eleven franchise brand, and set up Trader Joe's. And one of the third thing that Trader Joe noticed, as you briefly brought up, was the notion that of self-expression. We have a better educated people. They're traveling around. They're experiencing all kinds of new food. And somehow advertising falls into this category.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He noticed that in network TV. At that time, network TV had some ungodly percent of the market. Everything went through network TV, and it was very homogenous. And he just thought, this is not going to stand. People are not going to be happy with this homogeny. Now, in our world right now, where we have, you know, Twitter feeds individualized to us personally and hundreds of channels on cable TV to flick through, this may seem obvious. But again, he was doing this years before. In the mid-60s, he was coming to these realizations. And
well, he was seeing things that weren't going to happen for 10 years.
Yes, exactly. And he realized how dependent the supermarket was on that homogeny. So the way that the supermarket was oriented is it just was basically a landlord selling brands that were nationally advertised. So you would watch a show, Amos and Andy, or radio show, or I Love Lucy, and before that there would be some nationally advertised soap or this product, and then you would go to your supermarket and expect to see that there. And that was fine if that homogeny stuck. But for people who wanted something different, and again, of course, counterculture is rising at this time, for people who felt like they were individuals who got educated, who traveled, were opening their minds to new things, like this wasn't going to be enough. They wouldn't want that national homogeny. They would want their own unique products. And at that moment, the supermarket wasn't even able to deliver that. It was so oriented around national brands, the perspective of buyers couldn't. They didn't want goods that would only be available in sporadic. They really wanted goods that would be around continuously.
Isn't that the mark of the city dweller, though? You really want what your neighbor can't find, so you can say, "Look at this tomato. This is not just a tomato. This is a dry farmed heritage tomato. And it's organic,
right.
And even biodynamic. And isn't it cool?"
And I think you're absolutely right. There's some superiority wrapped up in that, too. Urbane sophistication.
Yeah. A little bit of friendly competition, you know. It's what we want that'll set us aside a little bit, give us a little bit of our individuality back. Instead of all buying cornflakes, we want something else.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I think, in this book, and so right now we've kind of dwelled on the first, 80 to 100 pages. But when you start peeling back the layers, how much of that individuality is a marketing creation and how much of it still relies on bulk commodity goods that are lumped together for their lack of distinction? And then it becomes an act of marketing to differentiate
that,
them.
That must be the dark miracle of this American.
That's
super.
Where the darkness, because it's exactly right. That's where the darkness creeps in, because to continuously supply a store with the amount of goods, that 100,000 stock keeping units, SKUs that you were talking about earlier, requires a reservoir of goods, a conveyor belt for getting them there that is awesome, that is beyond, I think, what most people can imagine. And the commodity system that underpins it is so enormous that it creates places where you can't see through it properly. Yeah. The lines of supply get tangled like a thicket. And in those places where there is literally visibility problems in terms of figuring out where product was sourced from, the worst parts of human nature become enabled, because ultimately they're vying for lowest price.
Sure.
And they will choose unethical means of getting it.
That would fall under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Let's go back to Trader Joe's, because he's so much fun and not quite so dark. if you think about it, he is one really fun character. And so he looks at the American population. He sees what's coming down the line. And he does the most amazing thing in the world, which is tiki.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, another one of these kind of brilliant things. So Joe realized that the association between people who are health conscious and the people who cared about booze was extremely tightly correlated. And this made no sense to him, but again, non-judgmental observer, he called it a schizophrenia. He realized it was correct. And that really people who cared a lot about health food and discerning tastes and that biodynamic tomato you were discussing also loved variety in terms of booze and cocktails. And so he...
As did he, correct?
You know, Joe, I don't think Joe cared so much for booze. In fact, Joe learned a tremendous amount about wine over the course of Trader Joe's. And in many ways, you can think of Trader Joe's as taking the principles of wine marketing, vintage as opposed to brand, and applying it to food. But he personally did not drink much wine. In fact, he told me, I think he drank Paul Mason cooking sherry to relax until very late in his life when he discovered wine. Eventually he does become, I think, something of a wine fan because he learns about it enough. But it was a business decision first.
Yeah, but let's, before we get into wine, which is an incredible story, tell us why tiki? You go into Trader Joe's and it's tiki trap. It's so silly.
It's so silly. I think there's a couple reasons. One, it knits together that observation of like people who care about individual foods and booze are basically on the same radar beam, as Joe would say. And tiki bridges that gap because tiki invokes travel and it invokes the booze. Also, he was in Southern California, and at this time, there were marine junkyards that were selling marine artifacts extremely cheap. So the original tiki decor, the original marine decor at Trader Joe's was a cost savings. He would just go down to these scrap yards, pick up different marine artifacts and bring them into his store and use those as design because they were simply cheap. At the same time, I think, you know, tiki kind of stood for a certain, you know, in the book, I think I talk about how it stands in for a certain naivety, American naivety, that both expresses the desire to have an open mind, but also there's something very comforting about it. And that was something that maps on to the Trader Joe's experience really well.
And you also tied it into Tales from the South Pacific, which was a James Michener novel and, of course, a big Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. In 1960, it was a pretty big deal. But not so much anymore, but it's still there. The tiki is still there at Trader Joe's, and so is that originality. You talk about wine. You brought it up briefly previously, but it's an amazing story because he took one look at wine, and he decided that no one really understands the business.
Yes. Yeah, and that was another, you know, so we talked about Joe wanting to have the highest paid employees. And the reason he did is he wanted the best paid buyers because he wanted the most intelligent people looking at the supply chain. And a lot of that realization came from the wine industry, where he realized wine is a heavily regulated industry. It was more so back then. There was rules called fair trade, which dictated how and why stores could sell products. And he just realized his competitors were acting out of routine, and no one was studying the legal apparatus. So if he learned about that, he could beat people on the minutia of trade He also learned, you know, that tasting wine, there was a tremendous ability to influence consumer perception, and that, and so he set up a big apparatus where he would just taste, you know, I think at one point he told me they were pulling 60 corks a day and tasting wines. Of course, they would spit this out. He'd put a big urinal in the backyard of the Pasadena headquarters where they would spit it out. But where they would just experientially learn about food. And what you have to realize is this is not how most grocery stores operate. They are not dedicating this amount of time to the tasting and learning about food in the supply chain because they can't. Not because they don't want to, but if you have 100,000 different units, you can't become master of them all. And what Joe realized was he could shrink his offerings down to a human scale. That's why Trader Joe's often won't have products you're looking for. They don't try to offer everything. But what they do offer, they try to invest their, you know, human minds and creativity into it, learning about.
Well, one of the wine stories you tell is relating to the fair trade pricing mechanism, which essentially, as I understand it, forced everybody to sell wine at the same price. But he found a hole in that program and drove a truck through it. Would you describe that?
Yeah. So fair trade essentially said that the price that an exporter is selling wine for is what the retailer needs to sell the wine for. So you can't compete on price for wine. So everywhere else in the grocery store, people are looking over their shoulders at what competitors are selling. But for probably for kind of blue law like reasons, they didn't think that was a great idea to do for wine. It also would protect small independent businesses so that a big chain couldn't just like cheapen the price and sell cheap booze to everyone. So these were regulatory hurdles within the wine industry. And Joe realized that a lot of that was just received wisdom. And what you have to understand about, you know, fair trade laws in California in the 1960s was that it was not some clean sentence in a book. This is like, there's court cases deciding it, regulatory boards. There's a lot of minutia. And he discovered through this minutia that if he, depending on who the exporter, the wholesale importer of the wine was, they could mark up different prices, which was just something that no one else in the industry was paying attention to. And once he figured this out, he found a veteran importer who he then asked to import wine at his, Joe's prices. And he just shattered the price of wine. And, you know, he was selling Latour for like $5.99, you know, bottles of these extremely expensive French wines for absurd prices.
And still
and
is.
And in the process became the leading importer of wine to California at the time.
Which is a remarkable feat in itself. Another great lesson he learned was from an egg man who was trying to sell him AAA-sized eggs, big ones that nobody else would buy. And he learned a very interesting lesson from that about discontinuous supplies. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this was actually back in before he had even started Trader Joe's. He described this, I think, to me as this was his light bulb moment. This was one of the formative decisions in like understanding all the ways that other grocery stores were failing their consumers and all the ways that they had fixed mindsets that were kind of preventing them from even thinking about problems in the right ways. So an egg guy comes up and he says, Joe, I have AAA extra large eggs that I can sell you for cheaper than the double A eggs that you've usually been buying. And Joe says, this doesn't make any sense. Why this is a better product for less money. Of course I want to buy this. Why are you only offering this to me? And why doesn't Safeway down the street snap them all up? And the guy explains to him, well, it takes a really big hen to lay a AAA egg. And these tend to be the females that are elderly. And so over the summer, when it gets hot, they start to die off. And so AAA eggs tend not to be around for different seasons of the year, creating a discontinuous supply. And Safeway buyers were terrified of a moment where a customer would walk into the store and discover a stockout, an empty shelf, no AAA eggs available. And they were absolutely phobic of this and wouldn't touch them because of that. Whereas Joe thought, okay, this is an insight into the supply chain that I need to learn more about because this is an opportunity. I will stock these and they'll fall out of fashion, but my customers will ultimately be happy with me for selling them something that's better and cheaper, even if it's not around year round, especially if I can message that. And that really became a whole ethos for his chain. How do we find these moments like that, that other people are overlooking because it doesn't fit their mindset of how a grocery store should operate?
Well, the ladies and gentlemen, there you go. There's a taste of how 7-Eleven begat Trader Joe's, a little bit of fun history. And we want to thank Benjamin Lohr, who is the author of The Secret Life of Groceries, for telling it to us. And we ask that you all remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.